Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. 50 currencies, 170 countries. One account designed to take on the world. So whether you're taking on Rio or Rome, Miami or Mumbai, you'll always get the mid-market exchange rate when you convert currencies, with no markups and no hidden fees. Wise helps you save money no matter where you're going next. Join 15 million people and businesses who are going global with Wise. Learn how the Wise account could work for you by downloading the app or visiting wise.com/world.
Many unanswered questions in the aftermath of India's deadly train crash and calls to invest more in India's railways.
If you run a system at 100%, 100% of the time, then it's going to break.
Also today, the daily realities of life in Kyiv, where residents have recently witnessed intense aerial attacks.
I think these bombings are strong now, and we see it, we feel it, and we're trying to be stronger.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today in Haiti, vigilante justice seems to be working.
For the first time, we have the gangs. They seem to be in retreat. They are on the defensive mode.
But there are costs with taking the law into your own hands. Plus, in Paris, it's Listen and Write on the Champs-Élysées, a mass competition to find out who's the best at dictation. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for being with us. It has been 3 days since a catastrophic train crash in India. At least 275 people were killed and hundreds more were injured. People were still lined up at hospitals today, waiting to identify bodies of their loved ones. Meanwhile, authorities are still trying to pinpoint exactly what went wrong. From Mumbai, reporter Namrata Kolachlam has the latest.
On Sunday night, the country's railway minister, Ashwini Vaishnav, raised his hands in prayer as another train was finally able to leave the Bahanga Bazaar station. It's been a painful weekend in the district of Balasore as rescue teams worked in the scorching heat to find survivors. The Indian Army joined rescue operations while 200 ambulances shuttled crash victims to hospitals and sniffer dogs searched the wreckage for bodies.
When I came out of the coach, I saw limbs scattered all around. A leg here, a hand there, someone's face was disfigured.
That was one survivor talking to Indian broadcaster NDTV about the horrifying minutes after the accident. Exactly what happened Friday evening became clearer over the weekend. Three trains collided when a crowded passenger train suddenly diverted onto another track. Traveling at 80 miles an hour, it crashed into a parked freight train. This sent a few of the coaches veering onto a neighboring track, where they collided with yet another train moving in the opposite direction. On Saturday, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi visited the accident site and offered his condolences to the grieving families. The people we've lost will not be able to bring them back, he said, but the government is with the families in their grief. The Prime Minister promised that those responsible will be severely punished. He also said that victims will be compensated, about $12,000 for the families of those who died, with smaller amounts for those who were injured. Many will need this financial support. In India, trains are highly accessible for the country's poor. And it's likely that a large number of migrant laborers were on that train who support their families through low-wage jobs.
Indian Railways is the lifeline of India.
That's Swapnil Garg, a former officer of the Indian Railway Service of Mechanical Engineers.
It is the most affordable mode of transport, most convenient mode of transport, and just about available everywhere.
In the aftermath of the collision, there are renewed calls for improving safety for the 13 million riders who use the railways each day. Many experts say the railways don't have enough staff to meet the high demand. There's simply too much strain placed on the creaking 19th century network. Although Garg feels that railway officials do prioritize safety, he adds,
if you run a system at 100%, 100% of the time, then it's going to break.
High capacity and understaffing are not the only issues. The government has invested in more flashy types of infrastructure projects, while funding for safety measures has reduced. In fact, before the train collision led him to travel to Odisha, Prime Minister Modi had been slated to inaugurate a new semi-high-speed train. This has prompted some railway experts to argue that this funding would be better spent improving safety of the existing trains. Still, The network that carries 8 billion people to their destinations each year has become a lot safer with time. In 2020, the government announced that for the second year in a row, there were zero passenger deaths due to train accidents. But now, the government is facing mounting pressure to explain what happened. Railway Minister Ashwini Vaishnav asked for patience while facing calls for his resignation.
Let the inquiry report come out, but the cause of the accident has been identified and the people responsible have been identified.
Critics say that the new anti-collision technology, the Kavach system, could have prevented the accident. But so far, it's only been added to 2% of the tracks. Vaishnav says the technology wouldn't have stopped the disaster. Instead, he announced that the error was caused by the train's electronic interlocking system, a signaling system that may have mistakenly led the first train to steer onto the wrong track. Additionally, the government has taken the unusual step of asking the Central Bureau of Investigation to look into the collision. This suggests that they're also considering whether this was sabotage. Meanwhile, family members press for answers and accountability while still searching for their missing loved ones. For The World, I'm Namrata Kalachalam in Mumbai.
For months, we've been waiting to see if and when Ukrainian forces would go on the offensive against Russia. Now we're getting some clues via social media. Ukraine's Minister of Defense, Oleksiy Reznikov, cited a 1980s synth-pop hit yesterday. It was in a tweet from his official account. He was quoting the song Enjoy the Silence by Depeche Mode. Words are very unnecessary. They can only do harm. Reznikov's tweet included a video. It shows Ukrainian soldiers in full combat gear. They hold their fingers to their lips in that universal gesture, urging silence. The message on screen reads, "Plans love silence. There will be no announcement about the start." But we're actually hearing more than silence from Kyiv. On Saturday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was asked about the much-awaited counteroffensive. He told a reporter for the Wall Street Journal that Ukraine is ready as of today. He said, "We are ready to do it. We would like to have certain things, but we can't wait for months." Then this morning, Ukraine's deputy defense minister, Hanna Malar, posted a message on Telegram. She confirmed that in some areas, Ukrainian forces are already engaged in what she called offensive actions. That is a big change. British and American sources are also talking about stepped-up artillery strikes by Ukraine along the front lines. Another source, less reliable, has been talking, the Russian defense ministry. It claims its troops resisted a large-scale Ukrainian attack on a Russian-controlled area of the Donetsk region in eastern Ukraine. Ukraine denies having any information about any large-scale offensive there, but fighting has continued all along the front lines. We'll let the last words go to a fake version of Russian President Vladimir Putin. This supposed address was heard on Russian radio and TV in regions along the Ukrainian border. In this recording from a car radio, the fake Putin calls on Russians to evacuate deeper into Russia because of an invasion by the Ukrainian army. Russian officials called it a hack and disinformation. Meanwhile, what is real? The aerial attacks that the Ukrainian capital Kyiv has been witnessing. The World's Carolyn Beeler is in Kyiv, which has seen 20 attacks since the beginning of May. Carolyn, what are you hearing from people about the toll this has all been taking on them?
Well, this is the closest that the war has felt to the Kyiv residents I've been speaking to since Russian troops pulled out of the region more than a year ago. There have been only 9 days, by my count, in the last month when residents here have not heard an air raid siren. And new government figures show that more than 250 missile and attack drones have been aimed at the city since the beginning of May. So it's, of course, taking a toll. People aren't sleeping, and they're worried because even though Ukrainian air defenses have been intercepting these missiles, the debris from their explosions have killed people, including two women and a child last Thursday. I spoke to one woman, Irina Tepluk, an English teacher at a university here who lives just 2 blocks from where that happened.
We heard everything. It was awful. Yes. Yes, it was awful. Our windows were shaking, but we were safe. But people who were very close to that epicenter, yes, they hurt.
Like just about everyone I talk to here, Tepluk says she, her husband, and her son are not sleeping much because they're just waiting for the air raid siren to go off every night.
We hear this alarm and we jump from our beds and in the corridor.
And is that different from maybe a month or two ago?
Yes, sure. I think these bombings are stronger now, and we see it. We see it, we feel it, and we're trying to be stronger.
Is everyone like Irina Teplouk paying more attention to the air raid sirens than they did when the airstrikes were not as frequent and, you know, kind of complacency set in?
I think more people are seeking shelter more often than the last time I was here back in February, but it's still definitely not everyone.
Now, last night in Kyiv, Carolyn, was a rare night with no attacks and no air raid sirens. Are people feeling relieved?
Yes, Marco. It's like the entire city of Kyiv finally got a good night's sleep on the same night last night. I talked to two university students walking out of a restaurant this afternoon who both used the word amazing to describe how they were feeling. Kate Yushko does most of the talking here.
It was really good because we feel more rest because of that, and we can sleep well, and we don't wake up every night for a couple of hours.
How long had it been since you slept through the night before last night?
Well,
1 month.
1 month, yes, 4 months.
You must feel like an entirely new woman today.
Yes, of course. Yes, and we met with my friend today to celebrate it because this is because we're leaving and this is really good.
Now, everyone here says they know this is just kind of one night of respite, and many of them mentioned how they know that the military and people closer to the front lines are not getting this kind of break.
Yeah, wow. Finally, Carolyn, as we heard earlier, there are a lot of rumors and speculation about this long-awaited counteroffensive from Ukraine. What are you hearing in Kyiv?
Well, authorities here have said that these reports from Russia are misinformation, though they have also mentioned that they will not be standing up and announcing the beginning of this spring offensive. But the folks I've been speaking to on the street, you know, they know that this war has been happening. It will continue. And while they anxiously await victory, which, you know, so everyone here is confident of, they're not so concerned about the official start of this next phase of the war.
The World's Carolyn Beeler reporting in Kyiv, Ukraine. Thanks very much, Carolyn. Stay safe.
You're welcome, Marco.
An odd scene yesterday in Paris on the famous Champs-Élysées. It looked like a giant classroom, some 2,000 desks neatly lined up, and throughout the day, more than 5,000 people competing in a mass dictation contest.
Pour la gaieté, virgule. Alors la gaieté, virgule. Là, un petit piège, je dirais.
Facing the throngs were several organizers who read passages from classics and modern works, while the contestants, ranging in age from 10 to 90, followed along, putting pen to paper. The dictée, as it's known, is routine in French classrooms. To the dread of many students, it'll happen sometimes every day. A teacher reads, the students write what they hear, and try not to make any mistakes in grammar or spelling. In France, where there's an agency of the government, the Académie Française, to monitor words and any violations to the language, an exercise like dictation is taken pretty seriously.
En relisant ta lettre, je m'aperçois que l'orthographe et toi, ça fait deux. Ce toi que j'aime ne prend qu'un M par-dessus tout.
For those of you who don't speak French, the singer there is criticizing the grammar of a love letter. Where else in the world would you find that? The late, great Serge Gainsbourg in his song En relisant ta lettre, or Rereading Your Letter. He takes us to the break.
Je suis l'esclave, sans accent grave, des apparences. C'est ridicule, c'est majuscule, c'était si bien. Tout ça m'affecte, ça c'est correct, au plus haut point. Si tu renonces, comme ça se prononce, à m'écouter, avec la vie, comme ça s'écrit, j'en finirai. Pour me garder, ne prends qu'un.
Just ahead, how the winner of Thailand's recent election could be banned from politics before he even takes office. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Thailand, the man who came out on top of the election 3 weeks ago is now assembling the most progressive government in the country's history. Pita Limjaroenrat was attending an LGBTQ pride event on Sunday, where he announced in a mix of Thai and English that one of his first moves as prime minister will be making same-sex marriage legal.
ไม่ใช่แค่ Pride Month, มันคือ Pride Always.
It's not Pride Month, he said, it's Pride Always. Pita is also promising to overhaul Thailand's conservative and military-dominated political system. Perhaps, not surprisingly, he's getting some serious pushback. Political opponents are threatening to ban him from politics. The World's Patrick Nguyen joins us from Bangkok. How exactly would that work, Patrick, banning someone from becoming prime minister?
It's kind of a technicality. So there's a law in Thailand that says politicians cannot own shares in media companies. And it turns out Pita does own shares in a TV channel, but the channel went out of business 16 years ago. And he didn't buy the shares, his father passed away, and he automatically inherited them. So the spirit of the law says, yes, lawmakers shouldn't control TV channels and newspapers. That makes perfect sense. But what we have here is someone who owns about $6,000 worth of shares in a TV channel that does not exist. So it doesn't give him any insidious sway over the media. So many people who voted for Pita say this is obviously a flimsy pretext to stop the most progressive Thai leader from taking power.
Yeah, and if you listen to what Pita supporters are saying, what's really going on here? Well, what's the backstory?
Well, Pita is fairly young. He's 42, and his party, the Move Forward Party, is also full of young politicians promising to change Thailand forever. And that's what's really going on here. Legalizing same-sex marriage is just scratching the surface. They want to eliminate the military draft. They want to slash the military budget. They want to get rid of laws against free speech. So they represent a serious threat to the military establishment. And Thailand has had more than 20 army coups in its history. After the last coup in 2014, the army junta installed its own people in the courts, in the election commission, in every powerful arm of the state. And that is the election commission that is ruling on whether or not Pita can become prime minister. And now they're even talking about banning his entire party all over these TV shares.
So essentially you're saying that that commission is run by the military and it would be the military that would stop Pita from ascending to the premiership.
Yeah, the last military junta installed that election commission. And, you know, I might add that former army generals also ran in this same election, army generals that have actually overthrown the Thai government before. But that was not a disqualifying factor, owning shares in a defunct TV channel. However, apparently that is a potential deal breaker for them.
And Patrick, if Pita does not actually become the next prime minister of Thailand, how do you think voters could respond?
It's widely believed across Thailand now that the country is at a pretty scary turning point. The military apparatus did not expect this young liberal party to be so popular and to win, but they did. And now a majority of voters from the cities and the countryside, too, really have their hopes up. And it's dangerous to get people's hopes up and then yank them away. And on the other hand, the military elites feel like if we give power to these radicals, the country's conservative values will go down the drain, and the military will not be the central guiding force of the country, as it has been for the country's entire political history. So you have two sides that feel the stakes are existential. Election officials have about another month to decide on Pita's fate and the fate of his party, and everyone in Thailand is just holding their breath.
The World Southeast Asia correspondent, Patrick Nguyen, speaking with us from Bangkok. Thanks very much for this update.
Thanks, Marco.
If I were to say BRICS, and the first thing you think of is not building materials, but instead the group of countries that make up that acronym, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, you are a step ahead. Those countries are the BRICS, the BRICS. Together, they represent nearly half the world's population and a third of the global economy, and in the view of its members, a counterweight to the U.S. and Europe. Ministers from the group of five nations just met in South Africa. Sanusha Naidu is there and was following the meeting. She's a senior research associate at the Institute for Global Dialogue and joins us from Cape Town. So this group, the BRICS, it's a counterweight to U.S. influence. I get why Russia and China see value in sticking together, but what's the value for like countries like Brazil, South Africa, and India to be in the BRICS? Because they do have valuable connections to the U.S. as well, and I would assume they don't want to upset Washington.
No, I think the real issue for India, Brazil, South Africa, and they do form a subgrouping in the BRICS called IPSA. And IPSA actually preceded BRICS in the early 2000s around three democratic countries coming together to finance development projects in the global south. But I think for India, Brazil, South Africa, it's also about understanding what changes in the international system mean for them as democratic countries being represented or being members of the international community. All three countries have talked about UN reform. That's a uniting thread for them.
When we look at a country like Brazil, though, that was already being criticized by Washington for not totally condemning Russia's invasion of Ukraine, I'm wondering if any of these countries might be changing their view of Washington a little bit. Or are they just being practical and trying to court as many friends as possible and letting the chips fall where they may?
So I think for Brazil, it is a question of not necessarily saying, oh, I don't want to engage with Washington. I think Washington feels as if it needs to keep that control, but at the same time then criticizes countries for saying, well, you need to make a condemnation. I think none of the countries, particularly India, Brazil, South Africa, actually condone what's going on in Ukraine. But the problem here is that we are going back to a point in which we have to basically nail our colors to a mast. And once we do that, then, of course, you now say, I'm aligned to you.
Last week in South Africa, lots of other countries were invited to the BRICS meeting as friends. Are any considering joining or being formally invited?
Well, the impression you get is that they've all asked, they've all been placed requests to join. I think it's the membership issue that's going to push the BRICS to be much more pragmatic about where they want to see membership going. It's not going to just happen overnight. It's going to be given a lot of ventilation, a lot of discussion, and it's also going to be looked at in the context of how do the five countries remain the core of the BRICS and what decision makings that they would make that would basically take the BRICS forward and don't have their decision-making undermined by the membership expansion.
So at this recent meeting of BRICS ministers in South Africa, Iran was there, so was Saudi Arabia. What impact do you think the organization is hoping to achieve by including a country like Iran, just as Iran and Saudi Arabia are trying to get closer with the assistance of BRICS member China? I mean, this feels like an important subplot.
It is. It feels that the BRICS can also bring countries that have had political differences, tensions, particularly between Riyadh and Tehran. It may not be the best fit for them as well. It's a fragile kind of brokering of a peace deal, but it nevertheless enables two countries to come together.
With Russia getting especially squeezed by sanctions right now, does the Kremlin see value here in countering U.S. sanctions through a stronger BRICS?
Absolutely. I think if any country has a serious purpose, objective, and sees the intent, I think they will push for expansion. It's very much because they're kind of having a difficult legitimacy, credibility crisis in the UN. They need fora like BRICS to elevate and push themselves further up the international system, and it does give them that kind of space.
Sanusha Naidu is a senior research associate at the Institute for Global Dialogue. She joined us from Cape Town. Thank you very much, Sanusha.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
You are listening to The World. In 1963, a song from Japan made its way across the Pacific. Sukiyaki was sung in Japanese and has endured thanks to love from other artists.
It's been sampled by Dougie Fresh and Slick Rick. It's been sampled by Snoop Dogg. It's been sampled by Mary J. Blige. The song has just traveled through all sorts of interesting routes.
The story of Sukiyaki still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In Poland this weekend, hundreds of thousands of people marched against the ruling right-wing party. One thing that brought the protesters together was new legislation cracking down on Russian political interference. From Warsaw, Katie Toth reports that many protesters believe this supposedly anti-Russian law is actually lifted from Russia's own playbook.
Warsaw's streets are absolutely stuffed with bodies. Many are waving red and white Polish flags while wearing flower crowns and t-shirts with the Polish word for constitution. Others are waving flags for the European Union. And Wojciech Noworyta is holding up a sign saying that Poland's Law and Justice Party is on Russia's side.
It's colors of Russian flag, and it's abbreviation of the government party, and at the same time is Putin and company.
In a country with some deep-rooted historical reasons for hating Russia, these are fighting words. The Law and Justice Party backs Ukraine's fight against the Russian invasion, but the party has also been known for tightening control over the courts and state media and for stoking anti-EU sentiment. The way Novoruta sees it, these power grabs at home actually help Russia and other authoritarian regimes abroad.
I feel that I have to be here, that it's a very important moment in the history of my country.
That's why he made his way to Warsaw from Wrocław, more than 3 hours away.
To be Putin's friend, you don't have to be pro-Russia. It's enough if you are anti-European. Because it's good work for him to destabilize this part of Europe. To make mess, to make people hate, to make another Brexit. And it's very good for Putin.
Last Monday, Polish President Andrzej Duda said he would sign a law from the ruling party creating a commission to investigate Russian political interference. Duda said cases of Russian meddling all over Europe have shown this is needed. But critics said these were Russian-style tactics to crack down on the opposition's biggest figure, Donald Tusk, all in the name of going after Russia. The U.S. State Department and the European Commission spoke out about it.
Pan Andrzej Duda.
Dzień dobry, witam państwa bardzo serdecznie. Dziękuję za przybycie do Pałacu Prezydenckiego.
By Friday, President Duda announced he'd ask Parliament to water down the legislation. His turnaround was on people's minds in Warsaw this weekend.
As I'm a teacher, for me it's like giving back your essay without checking it first. So it's so hilarious that he signed something and then on Tuesday he decided to read what he has signed.
For Julia Budzowska, this law is an issue of principle, and it's part of what convinced her to come.
I had a lesson with one of my students who is 72. She is a retired math teacher, and she told me that she was coming in here. So I said, if she can come, we don't live in Warsaw, why not me?
The protests were way bigger than expected. Tusk had one other party joining in when he first called on people to march against the Law and Justice Party. But after the new law was passed, two more opposition parties joined in. Maciej Kisilowski at Central European University says this response shows the commission is just the latest in a series of mistakes by the ruling party.
I think they completely misjudged the sentiment in Poland. The Russian commission is part of the broader trend of people seeing these guys are bringing those issues just for partisan purposes, just to cement power.
Elections haven't been called yet, but they're expected in Poland this fall. Researcher Tom Junes says these protests show that the opposition can mobilize, something the ruling party has noticed too.
The perception of a lot of people is that, look, they might be prepared to start playing really dirty and the elections might very well not be fair.
We move on, we move on. That's what they're chanting.
Łukasz Galecki and his young son Felix brought a rainbow flag to the march in Warsaw on Sunday.
It is a republic if you can keep it, and we want to keep it.
Polish people are also facing high rates of inflation while the country debates history, LGBTQ rights, and abortion. Protesters say they won't let this new law stifle those conversations. For The World, I'm Katie Toth in Poland.
In Spain, police have arrested three men accused of yelling racist slurs at Brazilian soccer star Vinicius Jr. during a recent match. Vinicius is black. The incident happened on live TV and made international headlines. As Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona, it's also led to some soul searching in Spain.
Stephanie Villalta was adopted from Haiti as a baby. She's black and grew up in Barcelona with her white parents. She's 18 now. She says she never really thought about racism until one night last year when she and some friends went to a club. They wouldn't let us in, she says, making excuses that our IDs weren't valid. Finally, they admitted it was because we were black, she says. The doorman said, we don't owe you Africans any favors. I just started crying inconsolably, she says. I didn't know what to do, so I called my mom. When I got that call, it just broke me, says Stephanie's mom, Eva Villalta. I wished it had been me. I knew this day would come, so did Steph, she says. because this is a racist country. The question of whether Spain is racist is getting a lot of coverage now, following the slurs directed at Real Madrid soccer star Vinicius Jr. Many white commentators insist Spain isn't racist, but that yes, some Spaniards are. But Stephanie and other people of color here, they say, what's the difference? Stephanie says for the first time in her life, she's actively seeking companionship among other black Spaniards. It's not that I don't want to associate with white people anymore, she says, but with other black people, I feel more comfortable. We have the same shared experiences. For older people of color in Spain, Stephanie's is a familiar rite of passage. On a recent morning, 40-year-old Afro-Catalan artist Montserrat Anguiano enters her studio in an old industrial warehouse in Barcelona. She was born in Equatorial Guinea, grew up in Spain. She says she came of age doing portraits of white women, then thought, wait, I don't see myself in my work. She switched to painting abstract African imagery. She says it's helped her find her identity and deal with the daily microaggressions she faces. I'll be walking down the street, she says, dressed like a normal person, and elderly women, even not so elderly, will clutch their purses. Do they really think I'm going to snatch their bags? Often on the bus, she says, white Spaniards won't sit next to her. In the face of such fear and prejudice, Anguiano says the best thing people of color can do is come together to protect themselves and to educate others. And that's what's happening on a small scale. Take this recent workshop in Madrid for black families or white parents who've adopted kids of color. It's run by a group of volunteers at an NGO called Afro Diccionario. In this video, a mom complains that in her child's school, they call him Little Chocolate. Leading this workshop is Afro-Spaniard Laia Muñoz. She says little has changed since she was a kid in the 1990s. Something similar happened to lots of us, she says. In school, they used to sing the famous jingle for an ad for chocolate milk. Muñoz says in her workshops, they always give parents the same advice. Warn your children that at some point they'll hear comments about their blackness, but that being black isn't bad.
Y estaba en la pista de patinaje. Y un padre me gritó negra.
Muñoz says the first time she experienced racism, she was figure skating. A dad in the bleachers screamed negra, or black, she says, in a menacing voice. My dad confronted the man, she says, and they nearly came to blows. I thought, if my father has that reaction, being black must be something bad. Muñoz says after, she tried to scrub her skin white with a sponge. It took her years to embrace her blackness, she says, but today she says it's gotten easier, because there are more and more black people represented in society, from journalists to politicians to athletes to police. José Ramírez is an officer with the regional Catalan police known as the Mossos d'Esquadra. Ramírez's mom was Haitian, his dad Spanish. Today, he's taking his 4-year-old daughter, Emma, on a walk.
También en parte porque yo no había visto policías negros, había visto muy poquitos.
I became a policeman in part, he says, because I'd never seen a black officer, only in Hollywood films. Hopefully, I'm adding my grain of sand, he says, to the process of normalizing minorities in Spain. Ramirez says he longs for the day when no one will ask him or his daughter where they're from. That normalcy appears a ways off, as does full acceptance of people of color. A poll just this fall among young Spaniards found that 1 in 4 held racist views of some kind. And in local elections last month, Spain's far-right anti-immigrant party, Vox, did well. Spaniards of color say overt racism, the kind Vinicius suffered on TV, is painful to watch, but helpful in a way, because it exposes the problem. 18-year-old Stephanie Villalta says it also exposed a certain passivity among some teammates who supposedly stood by Vinicius' side.
Su equipo.
The entire team should have stopped playing, she says, but they didn't. They should have come together and said, we reject racism. This is the problem, she says. People just tell us, hang in there, you can bear it. In other words, she says, it's your problem to deal with, not everyone's, together. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
On the next edition of The World, more than 1 million Rohingya Muslims are living in refugee camps in Bangladesh. Life is so bleak there that thousands of Rohingya are trying to flee, attempting one of the most dangerous migration routes in Asia. It's a journey that takes weeks in wooden boats, hundreds of miles across the Bay of Bengal. Members of the persecuted minority are trying to get to Malaysia or Indonesia to find work and a new life, but many never make it. We've teamed up with the Associated Press to bring you an in-depth look at this perilous journey and those who take it. That's tomorrow here on The World. 60 years ago this month, a record from Japan topped the Billboard Hot 100 in the U.S. The World's Stephen Snyder has a story of the song and the origin story that's been all but forgotten.
Uemui Tarako was a number one hit in Japan for singer Kyu Sakamoto in 1961.
And then through a series of coincidences and miracles, a couple of years later, it took off and became a hit all around the world.
Michael Burdash writes and teaches about Japanese pop music. He's a professor at the University of Chicago. He says the song was written at a time of social upheaval in Japan.
You know, this is only 16 years after World War II. So World War II and the devastation that Japan suffered at the end of the war, as well as this sense of responsibility for the damage that Japan had done to the rest of Asia, is all very fresh in the memories of people.
The words of the song were written by prolific songwriter A. Roksuke. They go, "I look up as I walk, so the tears won't fall. Remembering those spring days, and tonight, I am all alone. I look up as I walk, counting the stars with tearful eyes." The words are melancholy, and Burdash says they reflect the unease that many young Japanese felt about their national identity.
This is a period right after the 1960 Anpo demonstrations, these massive popular demonstrations in the streets of Tokyo and other cities against the renewal of the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty. So it's a time of political unrest in Japan and dissatisfaction with the place Japan seems to be taking in the Cold War world.
The words are full of disappointment, in contrast to the melody, which is really perky.
The first version that became a hit outside of Japan was actually an instrumental Dixieland jazz version of it, released by the Kenny Ball Orchestra in England, and it makes a wonderful Dixieland jazz song.
The British record company gave the song a new title, Sukiyaki. Yep, they named the song after the well-known Japanese hot pot dish.
And then some DJs on the west coast of the United States somehow got their hands on the original Japanese language recording with Kyu Sakamoto. And it's sort of the stereotypical story. They played this record once and the switchboard lit up with listeners calling and saying, "What was that song? Play it again."
Then a major U.S. label released the Japanese single and it sold millions of copies. But the story of Sukiyaki did not end there. The sound of a koto, the Japanese stringed instrument. It sets the tone for a 1980 remake of Sukiyaki by the LA-based band A Taste of Honey. For some purists, the version was over the top. It's
all because of me. Yeah, if you've ever seen that album cover, they're like wearing kimonos and they're holding fans.
Filipino-American music scholar and educator Elaine Andres writes about culture and ethnicity. And the imagery did not sit well with her.
I think seeing the album cover when I was younger was like my first conscious encounter with Japanese exotification, really.
Her first exposure to the song was this version by A Taste of Honey. Untouchable memories seem to keep haunting me. How the
love's so true that once dead. And so, like, even when I was younger, I was like, this is really weird. The song doesn't even talk about sukiyaki, so why is it called that?
Andres says growing up, her family lived for karaoke night, and her big number was sukiyaki.
And of course, I started hearing it everywhere, you know, the original and then, like, all of its various covers. It's all because of you.
Por ti estoy aquí. She said,
it's all
There are many covers of Sukiyaki. Michael Burdash has heard most of them.
It's been sampled by Dougie Fresh and Slick Rick. It's been sampled by Snoop Dogg. It's been sampled by Mary J. Blige. the song has just traveled through all sorts of interesting routes.
And Professor Burdash says it's a good example of the enduring power of a good melody.
You know, the question I throw out to my students is this really a cover version of Sukiyaki by Kyu Sakamoto, or is it a cover version of this later R&B song?
And does it really matter? In Japan, the original is still revered as one of the greatest songs of the 20th century. Burdash tells the story of how lyricist Eiruksuke visited New York City in the 1960s. Sukiyaki was already a classic. Many Americans could whistle the tune, but few could understand the words that A wrote.
That's sort of A's punchline in the song, is he's really mad that, you know, his lyrics have seemingly vanished and people aren't understanding what he wrote and it's being replaced with nonsense.
And then Burdash quotes the lyricist.
But I still get royalty checks.
Even if many Americans miss the meaning, they still love Sukiyaki. For The World, this is Steven Snyder.
In Haiti, it seems there's some relatively good news for a change. Gang violence appears to be easing up. That's according to a new report by the country's Center for Analysis and Research in Human Rights. Their data suggests that kidnappings and killings are down dramatically in recent weeks. Haitians say they're getting out more, returning to shops and restaurants. But the reason behind the decrease in violence is worrying. A citizens' vigilante group, known as the Bois Calais movement, is confronting anyone they suspect of being in a gang. Widlaw Merancourt is a Haitian reporter and editor-in-chief of Aibo Post. He lives in Port-au-Prince. Widlaw, just anecdotally from what you've seen, does it seem safer on the streets of Haiti's capital these days? What have you seen?
Well, we are seeing a situation in the streets of Port-au-Prince that is unprecedented. For the past, let's say, 2, 3, and even 4 years, for the first time, we have the gangs. They seem to be in retreats. They are on the defensive mode. We have way less kidnappings, and I'm seeing people going out a little bit more often.
Yeah, I mean, this is a turnaround in a short period of time, you know, after years of violence. Why do you think it's calmer?
It is calmer because a month ago, the population had to fight back directly against the gangs when, you know, close to my house, about a minute from here, you know, the gangs attacked communities, you know, shanty towns. And the population had to organize itself to fight back against these aggressors who were heavily armed. And, you know, dozens of gang members, allegedly gang members, were killed by the population since then during this operation called Bois Calais. This operation see many communities having sometimes 10, sometimes a dozen, you know, members armed with machetes. Sometimes police officers join them, and they erected, you know, barricades all over the place so they can be there at night and sometimes during the day to sort of wait to see if gangs members are coming. People are kind of waiting to see how the gangs will react. And today, they are in retreat.
Take us back to this Bois Calais movement. It's Haitian Creole for peeled wood, right?
Absolutely. It is now clear that the Haitian National Police cannot protect the Haitian people. Many police officers were killed, and we have a force that is demoralized. And when the gangs came up the hills close to my house here at Churjo to attack people and install gang leaders so they can conduct more kidnappings and rape and killings, people said enough is enough. And they took their machetes and those who had guns. And this is the other side of the story too. Hey, increasingly, Haiti is becoming a little bit like the U.S. with the gun problem.
Well, you mentioned how the gangs came up on your street. And I was going to say, don't the Bois Calais, these vigilantes, don't they include several of your own neighbors?
Absolutely. I have many neighbors who are part of this Bois Calais movement, who organize themselves in my neighborhood. For instance, we have about 20 vigilantes, and they have many barricades, at least 2, erected at night. And you have young people in the neighborhood guarding them and making sure that, you know, if you are coming, you have to introduce yourself and say where you're going and why you're here. you're armed and you don't have a justification for that, things can go bad really quickly. And that's the other thing also that we are hearing more and more from human rights organizations. And we have instances where innocent people or people with zero ties to gangs were seized by vigilantes and brutally killed on suspicions or denunciations, and sometimes because they are enemies with some people in their neighborhood. So this is what happens when the state that has the duty to organize justice is rendered ineffective. And in my own neighborhood, I document with witness about 20 gang members, allegedly gang members who were killed. Many of them had guns with them, but some of them did not have guns.
What is the likelihood that innocent people have also been targeted by the vigilantes?
Personally, in my own neighborhood, the day after the first attack, I believe it was on 24th of April, I personally encountered a young man with dreadlocks, which was killed. And when I spoke to people surrounding the cadaver, they told me the guy was there on a motorcycle. He did not have papers with him, and he was kind of slow in responding. So people kind of took things into their own hands and killed him. But I spoke to one woman who know this young man, and this woman said to me, he's a student and he was not implicated in gang activities whatsoever.
Widlow, what have your neighbors told you about why they are ready to do the job of the police?
When you speak to people behind these barricades, what they tell you is we have to do something because the state cannot do anything. They have to do something because many of them actually were displaced from shanty towns, now controlled 100% by the gangs. So people kind of feel like they are desperate. And if they don't do anything, nobody else will come to save them.
And they're also, it seems, at least in the last few weeks, successful. Why is this citizens group, Wakale, able to do the job that the Haitian police are unable to do? Is that clear?
The gangs are sort of in a disarray. Many of them took to social media to sort of say that the population should redirect its anger against politicians or to say they are sorry that they did what they did to the population. However, people I spoke to are concerned that this period is not going to last because the gangs, they still control 100% of the places they controlled before. They are still heavily armed. They still have the connections with politicians and businesses that they had before. And they are still extremely powerful with a lot of money in their hands. And a lot of soldiers too. So if you're not dismantling them and taking the guns and money away, you still have the same problem that you had before. Without institutional solutions, the problems of gang violence in Port-au-Prince and in Haiti, unfortunately, is still a real concern.
Widlow Merancourt is a Haitian reporter and editor-in-chief of Aibo Post, speaking with us from Port-au-Prince. Widlow, thank you very much for your time again, as always.
Thank you.
Next time on the show, a new PR campaign from the Biden administration aims to persuade the American public it's enforcing immigration laws by showing what happens to migrants at the U.S. southern border. A rebranding campaign for U.S. border policy is that story for you tomorrow. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you again tomorrow.